with the waiting list.
Yeah, I just...
Are we good to go? All righty. Thank you, and welcome to today's meeting of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. I'm sorry, I seem to have a frog here today, and I have to excuse myself, I guess. What I'd like to do is open the meeting with Jim Willis, the director of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and he has a little bit of follow-up information for us, I think, and then we'll get into the part of today's discussion, which is an overview of the wonderful work that has been done by the interim task force, and for which we're very appreciative. And I should also mention that Paul Evans will be arriving whenever his travels allows him there. He was flying back from D.C. today, and he's somewhere between the airport and who knows where. So, thank you.
Sure.
Yes.
Is Mr. Evans going to give us an update on the inaugural parties and such when he gets here?
Well, we'll have to judge what he, what kind of shape he's in, and we'll have to see what kind of night he had.
We won't ask him.
All right, we're paying attention now.
Maybe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, professional staff. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. The issue that I'd like to address first, Madam Chair, with your permission, is a question that was asked yesterday by Representative Comp relative to the compensation and pension income over the past number of years. I prepared a memorandum for the chair and for the full committee that will tell you where we were and where we are now. I'm pleased to say that you will see percentage growth every year that we were able to track.
Okay.
There is one thing I would like to say, and that is that while we remained in third and sixth place, based on my testimony yesterday for each of those years, the incomes went up appreciably in between each of those years. So hopefully that will answer the question. And, of course, after you've had a chance to review the memorandum, if you have additional questions, I'll be happy to respond.
Thank you. And I'm sure that the general conversation will roll into future pieces of what we'll be talking about in this committee. Our goal is to overall increase the percentage of veterans in Oregon who are receiving deserved benefits and bringing some of those welcome federal dollars into our revenue streams. Thank you for this information.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Would you like me to go into the Governor's Task Force on Veterans Services?
Perhaps you could just introduce for the audience the task force. I would really like to personally thank all of the members of the task force who put in a great deal of time and energy, and I'm not too sure I'm that appreciative of 276 pages of reading material, but obviously a lot of work went into this book, and so I thank you. And while I understand that we'll have a presentation from part of the group, I know that other members of the task force are also here today. So, Mr. Willis, if you could maybe if we could have those who were on the task force stand so that we could get you identified, we'd very much appreciate that.
There they are.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much for your service and for all of what we have to deliberate on here today. And I appreciate you coming down. So with that, if you'd like to introduce the report itself and the presenters that we are going to hear from today.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I would be remiss in my duties if I did not point out that my Deputy Director, Paula Brown, is here, and my Public Information Manager, Tom Mann, is here. Both of them worked in direct support of this task force during its entire time of meeting, and Tom was the project officer and did a lot to create this document that you've all received, the actual task force report itself. So I'd like to publicly recognize them and their contribution before this committee. Basically, it's not saying too much to tell you that the work of this task force is the most comprehensive study of veteran services in our state since World War II. Another way to say that is that it's the most comprehensive study ever undertaken in the last 64 years. The 27 members who made up our task force came from all walks of life and came from various professions and gave a lot of their very valuable time and expertise and skill and ability in carrying out the duties of the task force. This task force traveled to 24 Oregon cities, and in each of those cities held hearings with public officials, and then in the evening held town hall meetings with any veterans who wanted to come. Literally hundreds and hundreds of Oregonians from every part of this state participated in the work of the task force and gave us input. These were actually listening tours that allowed us to hear, again, from local and state officials. It was not unusual for us to have state representatives and state senators show up at our public officials meetings, and then, of course, mayors, county commissioners, and other elected or appointed local government officials. The thing that I would like to also tell you is that there were 13 different tours of facilities that serviced veterans or were staffed by professionals who work in direct support of veterans. So we got a lot of feedback from facilities both in the metro area, in some of our urban suburban areas, and in some of our far rural areas of the state to determine how well they were meeting the needs of the veterans and where the gaps in service were. I appreciate very much the chair's comment on the lengthiness of this report. It is 277 pages, but I'll give you some inside information. If you read pages 4 through 9, you will understand the findings and recommendations that came out of this report and have a pretty good handle on what was accomplished. And then you can go to the individual chapters at your leisure and review them in some detail, things like transportation or reintegration or health care or what have you. So that's a little inside story here. I want to tell you that we see this report as really a four-year plan for our state, some of which you will hear in the terms of what we call task force bills that will appear before this committee. We reviewed those with you the other day. And, of course, then we have the in-house ODVA bills, most of which are housekeeping things that we're trying to get done. But the ones that are task force bills were driven by these outcomes, and some of these task force bills, of course, are directed at our delegation in the United States Congress through the use of resolutions and memorials. We think that we're going to have a terrific impact on veterans in our state, but also veterans across the nation through what we learned. This report has been shared with all of the state directors of Veterans Affairs in the United States. And I'm proud to tell you that two of them told me they were going to take the cover page off and put theirs on, and that would be the new plan for the state of New York and the state of Missouri. That made me feel pretty good, and of course, they'll receive a bill. In any event, I want to introduce to you three of the task force members who serve. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about them. Let me start with Mr. Dan Estes. Dan is the senior policy advisor to the Marion County Commissioners. He also was a chair of one of our three work groups, and I'll let him tell you about that experience. Also, you're going to hear today from Colonel Retired McCray. He currently heads up the very successful Oregon National Guard reintegration team. I think it's the top team in the United States, and the only persons that would probably disagree with me would be the Minnesota National Guard, and they're wrong. So I will tell you that the final person you're going to, or one of the other persons you will hear from, is Dr. Mike Burton. He is the Vice Provost at Portland State University. He is a retired Air Force Colonel. He lent much expertise to this endeavor in terms of the education support and allowed us to do a pilot project at his university where we put a accredited veteran service officer on campus to see if that would work. And it was highly successful, but if he wants to comment about that further, I'll let him do that because I shouldn't talk about my own people. I already know they're good, but I'd rather have it come from somebody else. So with that, Madam Chair, and with your permission, I'd like to ask Mr. Estes, Dr. Burton, and Colonel McCrae to come forward and testify before the committee.
Thank you.
All right.
Gentlemen, please. Welcome, and again, thank you. If for the record, as in whichever order you'd prefer, you can identify yourself on the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Burton, 2393 Southwest Park Place in Portland. I'm Vice Provost at Portland State, as was mentioned, a member of the task force, and I'm a retired Air Force officer, 28 years, a couple of combat tours in Vietnam. I should also mention that, for full disclosure, that I was had the honor of being a member of this body for about five sessions in, back in the last century, so I sort of know where you guys are going. Think about that,
in
folks.
In the interest
really
of full disclosure.
I served on the task force when I was asked to be on this. Of course, I come from a number of places on this. First of all, having I'm one of these people that took great advantage of the veterans programs back in the time when I got out of active service and got a lot of my education through that. I had some assistance from the veterans programs in a number of ways, both dealing with some physical and mental issues that I had coming out of the Vietnam War. And it was pretty easy to get those services in the days when I came out. So I was interested to find out what the situation was today. And I chaired the reintegration group, which dealt with a number, really sort of that initial span when the vets first get out of active duty or come back from a tour. And in Oregon, you should know that we deal mostly, of course, with the Oregon National Guard. That's our main thing. But it's not to overlook the fact that there are a lot of service people, men and women, coming out today who are leaving the regular service or in other capacities that are Oregonians and who we have to deal with. But it seemed like there was a gap that occurred today, that there's a lot of needs. There's 350,000 veterans in the state of Oregon. They're not all getting the services that they're entitled to. And so we wondered what the gap was. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, and you can read through the report about why that occurs. But I was impressed very much in Oregon, and Colonel McCrae will talk about this, about the efforts, at least here, the Guard is doing. And it isn't just for the Guard, but for service people to try to get them linked in, because a lot of service folks just simply don't know that they have those kinds of benefits. And that was very much in my interest. And then getting them in the road to get employment and to get education. And, of course, in my current capacity, was very interested in what happened with folks in getting their education. Mr. Willis mentioned, we set up to have a veteran services officer at Portland State for a period of time. This fellow came on in a fall term. He set up a table out in the quad at New Student Day, put a sign up, said, "Veterans, got questions, come here." We have 500 veterans at Portland State that we knew of that were getting veterans benefits. Out of a population of 25,000, that didn't seem right to me. I thought we're missing something. The first day that the VSO was out on the deck out there, he talked to 65 students, and within a week, about 35 of those were now beginning to get their benefits because they didn't know they could get them, didn't know how to get to them. And there's a number of good things that happened. First of all, these were students who were already at school. They already started, but this began to get them their benefits, their federal benefits, or their state benefits for help for education. And then, of course, following that on, the other things that those people needed to stay in school, which might be health care, family care, housing, all kinds of things that the veteran service programs could do. For the university system, anyone that gets a veteran's educational benefit, it's worth about $5,000 a year to us. So you can put it in terms like that. But the main thing is getting those people linked in a place where they're comfortable. They're coming out of a bureaucracy. They don't want to go back into another bureaucracy. They've had enough of that, and so we found that was important. And I think Colonel McRae will tell you, and we'd all feel one of the key things, for instance, when we deploy a brigade and they come back. Now, this with a guard, of course, you get them in a group, and with individual military coming out, you don't have them that way. But there's also a problem about reintegrating them in back into the real world, as we used to say. It's a 5-day death by PowerPoint program. The feds are really interested in getting them off of their dollar and putting them back on the state dollar. So there's a very short reintegration time, and they get this briefing from everybody telling them what these benefits are. They hold them there. If the individual thinks they've got a problem, and the men or women who are in that situation don't want to admit that because they're going to hold them there for maybe another 90 days, and you know what they want to do? They want to get home to family, whoever else. So there's got to be a better way to reintegrate the troops back into the program. And I think Oregon does a really good job of that with the state programs we've got, but there's just a lot more that needs to go on in the way of reintegrating.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Estes, 2862 Walnut Court in Humbert, Oregon. It was a great privilege for me to serve on this committee, to serve on this task force. I never served in the military, and that had always been a regret for me. And after spending the better part of a year with the fine men and women who supported this task force, going out into the communities, meeting veterans from all walks of life in all corners of Oregon, I think it's a regret that I feel even more sharply now. I guess I'll save the probably the meat of the presentation for Paul Evans. He can go over the details with you, but I really would like to impart to you the confidence that I have in the process that we went through. It was probably one of the most organized, comprehensive reviews that I've ever seen. And I've participated in a lot of task forces, and they're all rather formulaic. This one was not. This task force really took to heart the mission that we were given, to really dive into a system that is absolutely Byzantine at best, complicated beyond anyone's wildest imagination, and to try and make some sense of it, try and find out what our veterans need, and not just from a system perspective, although we did that too, but being out into the community, meeting veterans, finding out what they need on the ground. That was probably the one thing that sticks with me the most. The task force, as Director Willis said, went to 20-some meetings across Oregon. And by across Oregon, I don't just mean in the Willamette Valley where the population centers are. We were in Burns. We were in Baker City. We were down on the South Coast. We were in places that people don't want task forces to come and visit. And for the most part, I think people were polite towards us, but there were a couple places where we were approached and said, thank you for your presentation. Please go away now. We moved out here for a reason. And you have to respect that. And you kind of have to wonder, especially with our veterans, what's happened? What has the system done to them to make them feel that way? That they don't trust government. And that was a hill that we had to overcome. But I think we walked away with a much better understanding about how services can be delivered in a much more customer service. That's really the word that keeps popping to my mind. How can we interface better with our veterans? How can we make sure they receive the services that clearly they have earned? How can we make sure they're, and as Mike said, you know, the reintegration part is absolutely critical. Chair Cowan, you mentioned in your opening remarks about the unrealized federal benefits that we're not seeing. And, you know, Oregon's in a pretty tough economic time right now, and we're facing, I think, $1 billion in unrealized benefits for our veterans. And that's not just money in their pocket. That's money that they're spending in our communities, money that's going towards education, towards houses. That's a benefit not just to our veterans, but to our entire community. So I won't take up more of your time, but I want you to have the utmost confidence in the process that we went through to make sure that we were listening, to everybody who interacts in the veterans system. That's really what impressed me the most.
Thank you. Colonel McRae.
Madam Chair, I'm Colonel retired Scott McRae. I work with the Oregon National Guard. I work part-time, I'm proud to say, but right now I live at 13635 Southwest Stephen Court in Tigard, Oregon. When we started down this road with the reintegration committee or reintegration program for the Oregon National Guard, nothing existed like that, because until the mid-90s we were not deploying soldiers and airmen on a consistent basis like we had been. In the When we started down that road, the National Guard is funded at peacetime operations. They still are funded at peacetime operations. It stretched our ability to even get to where we could deploy soldiers and airmen to the extent that we were asked to do that. And so it was taking up all of our energy. Therefore, when our soldiers and airmen came home, it was basically, thank you very much, have a great life. We'll see you when you have a drill again, which would have been 90 days later. And we realized that we had a train wreck happening, because not only didn't the soldiers know where to go for help, their families didn't know where to go for help. We didn't even know where to go for help as an organization. So I had retired, and I was enjoying retirement very, really well and not doing much. And the guy sitting back here, General Mike Caldwell, called up and said, hey, you know, we're not doing much for our soldiers coming home. And I said, yes, sir, we know that. And so what does that have to do with me? And he said, we need a program to help our soldiers coming home. So that was in 2004. So we're still fairly new at this game. However, what we had coming home in March of 2004 was a battalion that had lost 9 soldiers in combat. And we found out, much to our amazement, that approximately 60% of this unit was unemployed, or the job they had to come home to was not what they wanted to come home to. So we really, when Dan talked about a Byzantine program, we started delving into what do we need to do, and what can we do, and how do we go about it. So we started meeting with organizations and agencies that provide support. At that time, we didn't deal with the VA very much, the ODVA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, or the federal VA, because only people that retired off of active duty really dealt with them, and we didn't have much of an experience. And what I might say is that both organizations, Jim Willis and the ODVA, and the Veterans Affairs, headed by Jack Himes, who was a member of the committee, stepped in, and it isn't the Oregon National Guard that has put a reintegration program together. It is a team that has put it together, and we really kind of proudly refer to it as Team Oregon. So we started down the road dealing with issues and working problems for our soldiers coming home. But as the task force went around, we found that part of the big part of the problem is getting the word out to our veterans, and then having them understand that really it's here as they've earned it. It's not welfare. It's not something that they should feel bad about collecting their rights. It's something that the country owes them for their service. So we have the same issue in the National Guard when our soldiers come home, and as Mike Burton pointed out, just an example, our soldiers that are in combat in Iraq, they come back to Kuwait out of combat, directly out of combat. The day they leave Iraq, they leave patrol one day and they go back to Kuwait the next day. So they spend 7 to 10 days in Kuwait turning in equipment, getting ready for their flights home, and doing the things that they need to do to get their equipment loaded in Connex containers and come home. It's busy, busy, busy. Then they get on a plane whenever the rotate flights come back to the United States, and they fly back into, at one time it was many military places across the United States, many military posts, installations, but now they mostly come back through Fort Lewis. So they come back to a military installation, and they are there from anywhere from 2 to 5 days. Some of them get a briefing within hours of getting off the plane on what their entitlements are. So you know, they call it circadian rhythm, right? I mean, they're on Baghdad, Iraq time, and we're on, you know, West Coast, Oregon time, or West Coast time. And so they're given this blitz of briefings on what their entitlements are. And really what they would do is they would sign over their house and their boat and probably even their four-wheel drive pickup just to get out of their briefing. That's pretty serious when they get when they get the four-wheel drive pickup signing that over. But just to get home, because they've been gone for a year to a year and a half, most of them a year and a half. And so they're getting all kinds of briefings, but none of them are taking it. You know, they walk out the back of the auditorium, and the recycle bin there is the most popular place, is where all their slides and stuff they're given. So what happens is they're still back in Iraq, is where they really are. Physically, they're in Fort Lewis, and then we're only authorized by DOD to have up to a maximum of 3 days in the state of Oregon. And those 3 days are, I mean, if you can imagine, a whirlwind of activity. And they're gone. And they're discharged. They're released from active duty back to the National Guard. So they're our soldiers on loan to the active component, and we have the responsibility to make sure that they get the benefits and the rights that they're entitled to. But we don't have a time to do it. One of the things that we pushed forward, and there's lots of things that chapter and verse, we could go into a lot of things, but one of the things that we're really trying to push, and we do have the best reintegration program in the nation, to include the active duty, I might add, but is, and on page 12 of the task force report, the first finding and the first recommendation is that Oregon is pushing to get additional time when they come back to Oregon where they are still on active duty. And Uncle Sam is paying for it, because we spend from 3 to 6 months training them to go to war. And we spend 3 to 10 days getting them out of it, back to home. And these are people that are put on now the resources that Oregon provides to take care of them. And the reintegration program that Oregon set up was funded completely out of the National Guard funding, taken out of HIDE, as we call it, to set up this program. And there wasn't one in the nation that was really working very well. And so we were one of the leaders in the nation doing that. But still, there are a lot of things that need to happen, and this is one of the things that we feel need to happen, so that we have a decompression time to bring them back, time to get them with their families, time to get the families and the soldiers together, bring them back to a location, have the VA talk with them about what the briefings are, have some pastors, counselors there to meet with the family, to talk about what it is like to be a family again, because they have separated as a family, and life is the only guaranteed thing that has happened is that they're changed. The spouse and the family at home have had to become independent. The soldier that goes away has had to, he's on an adrenaline high for a year because he doesn't know when he's going to get shot at or blown up, or he or she, either one. And now we bring them back together with no time to come back together to actually learn how to live together again. We don't have time for them to understand what their benefits are for health care, how to do their finances, how to do life as in general, and time to decompress and talk, and not only that, but talk with their fellow soldiers about what happened and have briefings and debriefings about what happened and what was good and what was bad and how to deal with the things that come along. Bring in employers and talk to them about jobs. I will say that in our journey in the last 4 years, we have worked with hundreds of organizations and agencies, federal, state, and local, and the only problem we have with the whole thing is there's so many that want to help them is we don't know how to use that help sometimes. So that's not the problem. It's how do we get the help that's there tied up with the soldier, airman, or their family, or any other veteran. We help any veteran that calls. We work with the Army Reserve. We work with the Navy Reserve. We work with any veteran from any service that calls us for assistance. So, but specifically on the task force part here is until we have a time in the National Guard to incorporate and reintegrate our soldiers and their families and airmen back into the community after deployment, then we're going to lose touch with them, and now it's hit and miss, and even though we do career and benefit fairs regionally and we have quite a bit of success there, is that when the units come home, they go back to Washington, Idaho, you know, wherever in Oregon, and we really lose the ability to get this information to them and to bring all the partners, stakeholders together to share with them what their benefits are, because they've earned it, but we want them to successfully go back to their community and not be a burden to their family, to themselves, or to their community. So that's I'll stop there.
Do you have any questions for this group of folks? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Unwinding when you come out of combat situation is very, very difficult. It takes different times for different people. I know for me, adjustment period was over 6 months. One day you're carrying an M16 with a 45 semi-automatic, and 3 or 4 days later you're out on the street in San Diego. No transition period at all. But my concern is that if we're dropping these youngsters off and not doing any adequate follow-up, what cause and effect are we having on the long-range psychological imbalance or balance of this individual? Because I know it's you colonels, were you not in country?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about. You understand that. And by the way, thank you and welcome back, soldier.
Thank you.
Appreciate your service. What are we going to do about that? Because it's a much more grave than you're even talking about in my mind. This adjustment period.
If I could, Madam Chair, Representative Spill, I think that's a key question. And actually, I'll say this up front too, because I think I was one surprised a little bit, because I've been out of touch really basically with what was going on in the sense of reintegration for a period of time from the time that I left and came back in. Surprised at two things. One is that there seemed to be much more, it was a lot more difficult generally, I mean, look at the national statistics, of getting our military personnel who are leaving combat zones reconnected in the right way. On the other hand, I'm very impressed with the way that the state of Oregon is dealing with it. What Colonel Crace talking about here is it's much better here, I think, than anywhere else. Now, the long-term effect of these things, what's happening right now, and Jack Himes is here, is with the Veterans Hospital, could give you better numbers on this than I could. The folks that are having the most difficulty right now with adjustments are where PTSD is showing up, or suicide rates, alcoholism, drug addiction, family breakups, those things, or the Vietnam vets. Because it's usually a ways out before this happens. So there is kind of a cook time. But the folks that are coming back now from the current wars that we're involved with, the biggest problem is the adjustment time it takes to get back used to coming from being in country, if you would, to coming back to the streets of San Diego, or streets of Portland, or streets of Burns, or whatever it is. They've been away from their family. They've been in an extremely high-stress situation. And some people can hold that pretty well. Some of them can't manage it very well at all, and it is a breaking point that it occurs. They self-medicate in a lot of cases to try to get through it. We were talking about suicide rates coming down. Suicide rates amongst military is high, very high, much higher than is, for instance, amongst university students, which is high as well. And there's lots of reasons for that. It's one of the things the task force in this report and all of us are most concerned about. Again, it's... And there's another thing about this, too, because when I was in the service, I went through commissioning program, and so I was a volunteer. But in the days when I was in the service, most of the people around me were not volunteers. They were draftees.
today everybody's in service is a volunteer, and there's a cadre and a camaraderie of arms that you don't want to let your buddies down. So you don't want to admit you got a problem. So there's a barrier, I think, that's a bubble about, I think, personal viewpoint, that's going to pop out there one of these days, because these men and women, and there's a lot more women today, by the way, I want to make sure you understand that, in combat roles than there were when I was in Vietnam, by huge numbers. But these men and women have been under extreme stress. They're brought back in some cases, and the boiler hasn't come off the top of the pot yet, I think. And we're going to see problems later on down the road, where if we're not dealing with the problems that these people have and bringing them into a situation to help them manage those problems that they're going to have, it's going to show up later. And it's like you say, nobody wants to sign away their house and their truck to get out of there. They probably shouldn't. That we need more time. Hopefully, you can get family members with them. That's something else I think should happen. When these folks come back, have that reintegration occur with the families there. A family member is going to notice a difference in somebody before that soldier does. They're going to say, you know, Sally, Bill, you're different than you were when you left here. And they're going to go and say, you need to get help. And that's one way to make that connection. Instead of later going home and then the wife or the husband says, my gosh, you're acting like a fool, I've got to leave. And then it becomes a second problem this person has. The kids don't know what's going on. That becomes another part of it. So it's a slippery slope, you're absolutely sure. We got to get a hold on that, make sure that doesn't happen to people, and that means intervening, if you would, or allowing these folks to know that they can be helped, and that it's not a disservice or dishonorable to get that help. It was really tough for some people to be willing to say, I need help. Some things, I mean, for me, I know a lot of things didn't show up until a lot later. Until I realized there was something was, you know, what was it that was going on? It took me a long time and some relationships as a result of that. And part of it was because I didn't want them to have a problem. And you've got to get to them that way. That's more than you needed to know. But.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
A couple quick questions. I actually have a son who's been in Iraq and he's been in Qatar and just came back over Christmas. And one of the things that I saw with him going into what you're saying is, I mean, there's a level of hate that he just has. And he said, Dad, I didn't think I could hate before. You know, when I was telling him, hey, you need to respect, but be careful. I mean, he came back with that. And one thing that he's had, and I don't know if you guys have looked into it with the guys that are returning, some sort of maybe mentorship program, that I'm able to do that with him. He's able to call. His last tour was in Qatar. And you're talking about the time change. It was actually annoying because he could use the phone there and he'd call me at 5 in the morning all the time on Saturday morning. So, but as much as I hated it, it was a time for me to counsel him and talk to him about issues. And he's one of the few that has someone he can call and get a hold of. But I think that's something maybe that you should look at in your plan as some sort of mentorship program for the married guys. I mean, there's marriage classes, things like that. So they can come back into it. I need to love my wife. I need to honor her and respect her, you know, and bring that back into their way of thinking, because they're in a whole different mindset because they're dealing with people that hated them and wanted to kill them. Mm-hmm. So, and that's their world for a year and a half. So I'm just wondering if those are things that you've looked at or talked about, and anything I think we could do as a board here I would be more than willing to support and help draft legislation or a memorial, anything like that, for reaching out to these guys, because I know it's a serious issue, because I know my son's heart and I know what it's done to him. So the question is,
I think you hit an extremely important point, and your son is lucky because you are there and available for that, and you somehow, he felt comfortable enough to make that connection and talk about those kinds of issues. That doesn't happen with everybody. One-on-one mentoring is probably the most valuable thing that could happen with people. And there are lots of volunteer groups and organizations around the state that will help make that connectivity for somebody that doesn't have it. The best and first point, I think, is with a family member. And part of what the reintegration team wants to do is to help get those family members aware of what they can do. Some of them just, you know, don't quite get it. or need to be sensitive to what the issues may be. So I think that's important, and that's some of the things that, I know that Scott, you're doing with the in making that connectivity. There's a lot of veterans groups, veterans organizations around that have individuals in the various cities that are willing to do that. One of the first things, I'll say this because I think Director Willis would probably make this point that's important. In the benefit side of this, there's sort of, you know, sort of the stuff you're entitled to and you should get, and there's lots of programs. Then there's the personal side, which is much more what you're talking about, that I think is more important, really. On the benefit side, we really want to get these folks connected to a qualified veteran services officer. These are people that are trained and certified by both the state and the federal government to understand what how they actually literally become at least a benefits mentor to that individual. They'll try to clear all the bureaucratic passageways for them, find out what their benefits are, help get these forms that people can't find, and they understand. Literally, the veteran can come in and they get a power of attorney, essentially, that the veteran services officer becomes can represent them to go get these records that they can't find, things like that. That's extremely important to get them into the right track, and that's over with the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration. But the personal side that you're talking about is getting that connectivity. You know, and I think the ODVA and the integration team are trying to find ways to get that done. You need to make sure that people are sensitive to what those issues are. How do you get them connected? Helping them understand those issues. And so, you probably found, if I could ask you, when your son first started calling, I would imagine you had a hard time dealing with that or not understanding quite what that was all about. Fortunately, as a father, you probably were able to figure it out because you knew your son well enough. But that I don't think happens enough.
It was one of the, when he made the calls, it was just having someone to joke with and kind of take the edge off of what he was dealing with there. So, and that's the thing. A lot of these guys don't have the parents, because I know some of his, the guys that are serving with him, they look to me as their dad as well. So,
got to sign him up.
Thank you.
That's good.
Are there other questions for this particular?
Madam Chair, if I may, back on the question that Representative Widener asked, in the National Guard and I will speak specifically on the National Guard because the Army has different programs also, but we have a family program that has been around for a long time that is comprised of volunteers across the state of Oregon, and each unit has a family volunteer that we work closely with. The reintegration program and the family program work closely with. We try to do for the soldier what the family program does for the family and get them information and be a conduit to be able to pull this together. We do have funding from the federal government to do, they call them marriage encounter weekends. And basically what it does is we bring in chaplains, we bring in the VA, we bring in people that do the softer skill type stuff to work with them. But it's usually after, you know, it isn't timed with a deployment or when somebody redeploys. It's whenever we can fit it into the schedule and whenever the funding is available. Now, it's great training and it's a great experience for the family that can participate. But again, if you have the training in Central Oregon, you know, then somebody in rural Oregon, they have to get there and you have to get the word out to them and they have to have the time available and be able to get time off from their job if they work weekends. So there are some constraints with that. When we talk about the additional time when they come home from a deployment immediately following, is we want to incorporate something like that into that time frame where we bring the families together and we teach them about living again with each other, but we also give them time with their buddies that they were in combat with to sit down and talk with each other about what their combat experiences were, because they don't have any time to deprocess that information because they come out of combat so quickly, they come back home so quickly, and they get released from active duty so quickly that they really don't get a chance to talk about some of their good and bad experiences and find out that the sergeant over there had the same experiences that the private did, and be able to share some of those common things.
Thank you. Representative Boone?
Yeah, I wanted to actually, Colonel, you hit the nail on the head, and that's something probably Representative Matthews has some experience in this too, is after a bad fire call or something like that, you get a debriefing with a tip team or somebody like that, and that's one time, maybe two in a bad weekend. But these guys are doing it day in, day out. And I attended a redeployment or coming home ceremony in Camp Rylea, and I was in among a long line of people going through the long lines of guys standing there, and we realized it. We were standing between them and their families, and they had to greet all the dignitaries. And somebody asked a guy, "How are you doing?" And he about burst into tears, and I was next. And it was like, we're required to report child abuse, animal abuse, all that stuff. And I felt like, I should tell somebody or do something, but I felt like I was intruding or would be intruding. And I was wondering, how do we do that where if we get a feeling or meet somebody and we see that happening, they're crumbling before our face, before their faces are crumbling before us, how do we make that connection and get them connected with somebody who could maybe intervene? I got the feeling this guy had no family there, and he was just, you know, they'd been standing there 2 hours already. So, and you mentioned a mentoring program or something like that, and if there's something that we could do to help facilitate that or connect it, you know, when we experience that. Because that, you're so right, just 2 days, 5 days, it's not enough to talk about. You got to talk about it over and over and over again.
Madam Chair, if I might hit on that some. I've worked with Jim Willis, and I have talked, and we kind of started a framework for a program. We haven't got it going yet, but it's called the Battle Buddy Mentoring Program. And the idea of that we have talked about in concept mainly was linking up somebody that's a veteran here, and Jim Willis has contact with all the veteran service organizations in the state, and getting people that they feel would be good mentors, and getting our soldiers that come back linked up with them. Again, we have discussed it in concept, but there's nothing, you know, there's nothing firm to do to work that now. But again, to make that happen, we need time to do it. And right now, we don't have the time. We don't get a chance to find out when you're standing there in the formation and somebody's ready to burst into tears and they're having problems already, then obviously we grab somebody there. But our reintegration team, we have magnets. I'll get you a copy of the magnet. But we have a magnet, and what we do as a reintegration team is we try to bring people together that can recognize that somebody's having trouble. They can be a conduit to feed them into a system or into an agency that can provide the help that they do. And that's really what we do as a reintegration team, is we try to find out what agencies and organizations provide assistance and volunteers and families, and work with the people that touch the soldiers, and try to provide that feeder conduit for finding out that when a mother calls and her son won't come out of the bedroom since he's come home from combat. Then what we do is we get a hold of somebody that's a professional, and get the two linked up. So that's what we try to do. But again, it's really tough because they live all over the state of Oregon or out of the state of Oregon, and they may only come to drill with the guard one weekend a month, or come for training, and they exhibit different behaviors when they're at training than they do when they're home. And so we have a lot of ways, you know, a lot of informal ways to do that. It's one of the reasons that we have a reintegration summit every 6 months to bring people together to say, okay, how are we doing? What else do we need to do? Where aren't we making the mark? And we have about 120 to 150 representatives from different agencies and organizations, and the governor's been there, and you know, the Senator Wyden has been there, and Senator Smith's representatives were there, and so we invite anybody that wants to come to do that to try to do this. So we have, what we're trying to do is formalize the mentorship or the Battle Buddy program some, but again, you need time on the back end because there's not time to do that now, and the soldier has to volunteer to sign up for a mentoring program, because you can't just throw them into one and say, well, this is what you get to do. So we need to be able to have time to brief them on what the program is and work that piece.
Thank you. Committee, what I'd like to do is remind you that that's sort of what we're trying to get our arms around is what it is that we can put together to be helpful. As you folks can see, many of the members of this committee have either had active duty experience themselves. We've had family members involved. We come out of emergency response situations ourselves where we understand the debriefing process that comes with whatever it is that you've been exposed to. I think that the information that what you've shared with us has been very valuable today, and I truly do appreciate it. You're beginning to touch on one of the things that's been kind of bugging me in the back of my mind as I read through the recommendations, and that in terms of extending the reintegration time, at the same time, you've got people who want to get back to their families. So I really appreciate you bringing out the fact that you're talking about bringing families in at the same time. I couldn't figure out how you were going to keep somebody in there for another 30 to 90 days and refuse to let them get in touch with their families, and that was really bothersome to me. So I appreciate that explanation. So what I think we'll do now is move to Paul's presentation on the report itself, which will help, and what I'd like the committee to think about is we're trying to get our heads around the proposed legislation that will be coming forward that hopefully we can do something to address some of these things. And I hope we've given you, Paul, a little bit of time to reintegrate to the committee. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Representative Compet to leave, so he's off the hook as far as his report, it looks like. On his activities.
Yeah.
Representative Comp was looking for a report on your
yes,
adventures,
ma'am,
in the last few days, but we will let you move to this task force report first.
Chair Callan, members of the committee, I do, for the record, my name is Paul Evans. I'm the governor's policy advisor for military emergency management of veterans, and I just again want to apologize and thank you for your indulgence on what has been a very weird trip that I can explain to each of you at a different time, mostly having to do with Delta Airlines, but my luggage,
by
the way.
It's not in the purview of this committee.
Correct, yes.
List?
Well, my luggage is in Minnesota from last I heard, so it should be an interesting week. The week continues. What I'm going to try to do over the next little bit, is that projecting up yet, or can you get that projected up? Sometimes when you talk about veterans issues, it is truly a convergence of a lot of different issues. And what I'd like to do for the next 15 or so minutes, try to run down some of the facts, figures, and basically the broad framework for what we're trying to do. And then there was a number of questions that I heard that I kind of want to respond to about some of the things that we are working on. But before I get there, it was mentioned about the inauguration, and the party stuff we can talk about later, but there was something that happened that has a bearing on today. 1.8 million to 2 million people of different backgrounds converged on the Capitol. Not all of them had voted for the new president, but all of them wanting to see the peaceful transference of power. And sometimes I think in this building especially, people focus on the calendar and the next meeting and the next meeting and the next meeting. And I just want to say thank you for what you do. I mean, ultimately, men and women wear uniforms to stand a post to protect something that's special, and it's upon your shoulders that something special continues. So thank you for what you do. Today's presentation, we're going to cover basically the veterans landscape, task force on veteran services, some of which I understand has been already discussed, the draft recommendations, the roadmap, some things I call game changers, and then a brief summary. Some of this has probably already been mentioned. I apologize if that's the case, but for those out in TV land, hopefully these numbers will help. Sometimes it's important to know the size of the fire that you're fighting, as a member would, several members would attest to. 350,000 veterans in Oregon. That's actually probably not even an accurate number, but that's the best guess the census could give us. And you're going to see lots of different numbers. What I'm going to try to do is with each number give you the source so you can understand why there's some confusion. So about 350,000 veterans in Oregon, but there are only 80,000 of those 350,000. that are currently enrolled in some form of services having to do with veterans. Not all benefits. That doesn't mean they always get anything at all. They may just be enrolled, waiting to find out more information. It may involve education. It may involve health care. It may involve payments. But there's 80,000 of the 350,000 that the Veterans Administration sees when they look at Oregon. And the important thing is, when you look at veterans policy, though it's about the men and women that serve, ultimately, it is a bureaucratic function, and numbers matter. So one of the things that we recognized as we went throughout this process, that we needed to understand really what's been happening looking at the numbers. Of those 80,000 that are enrolled, some get receive a higher amount of benefit than others, but as a group, about $1.12 billion. We think a little bit more than that, but that's a fairly conservative number. But we look at that, and we look at 270,000 of the 350,000 that the census say are out there that aren't enrolled. And if they're on roughly the same numbers in terms of benefits and proportions of folks that would be getting some kind of benefit for services earned, that's about $4 billion that we're leaving on the table. And in the town hall meetings that we had across the state, of which we had about 24, I used to say that counting veterans is like counting salmon. They move and they don't always want to be counted, right? So, and again, veterans especially sometimes just have a distrust of the government for any number of reasons. But we recognize that one of the major things the task force has to do, even if it's simply raising awareness, is getting the message out to vets that even if you don't have any particular benefit coming your way, it's still worth the effort to find out. And by doing that, you'll actually be helping other veterans, and we'll explain how that works in a minute. So let's look at the, before we get into that, let's actually talk about how we structured the task force. I understand Director Willis talked a little bit about that. But we really have, of those 350,000 veterans, that includes World War II Korea, that includes Vietnam era, that includes, quote-unquote, the Cold War period, that includes current era veterans. Not all those needs are the same. So we really tried hard to make sure that those lenses were looked at by some of our committee structures. We also looked at the different needs of folks at different with different experiences. I'm going to emphasize the OEF-OIF impact next on the slide, but I want to emphasize that we're still learning a lot more about the OEF-OIF cohort as this war unfolds.
Could you explain the acronym?
Operation Enduring Freedom, which is Afghanistan. Operation Iraqi Freedom, which is Iraq. And right now, in terms of the DOD, though they are separate theaters, you'll hear those numbers put together often because they are combined in what the previous administration had called the Global War on Terror. So, Oregon National Guard mobilizations. We've had about 7,000. We're going to have another 3,000 or so coming up in about 3 or 4 months. There's been about 4,000 reserve mobilizations. Unfortunately, the reserves sometimes get not a lot of attention because the Army does some things with the reserves that they really can't do with the Guard. Reserves are part and parcel, a fully federal organization, and legislative support and congressional action sometimes does not work as well in the reserve elements as it does with the National Guard that has a legislature and governors and congresspeople that can actually identify where those units are. But the best we can get to is there's been about 4,000 reservists mobilized. And then there are a number of unknown Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom veterans that got out of service and moved to Oregon or moved back to Oregon. And unless they self-identify, we really don't know who or where they're at. And that's one of the most frustrating things is you start looking at policy, you're like, well, of course someone's taking care of that. Well, there's no linkage right now from when a person gets out of active duty unless they ask to send their DD Form 214, which is their official record of discharge, to the state or to some agency. Once they're out of the active duty, no one knows where they're at unless they're tied to some other program. So let's look at the other parts of the veterans landscape that's not as easy really to look at as the numbers. First, when President Bush went to war, we did not institute an involuntary draft. That's an important thing because in the past, having a draft was an important component of not only fighting the war, but managing the manpower requirements for the war. The U.S. also did not significantly expand the size of the all-volunteer military. We are still struggling to get the 90,000 extra billets filled for the Army and the 25,000 extra billets filled for the Marines. Often you'll hear comments that those numbers have been filled, but the real truth is if you look at the involuntary activations of the inactive ready reserve are actually filling some of those billets. So the fact of the matter is we've really not expanded the size of the military significantly. That actually plays a role because troops are now serving longer and they're serving more often, and there is an unknown impact upon the readiness of the future force and an unknown impact upon veterans' long-term care. Representative Esquivel was talking about that. I want to put this in a little bit of historical context. World War II, specifically World War II, a little bit to Korea, it was customary for line units to be engaged in active combat for 3 or 4 months generally and then be pulled off the line. In the Pacific Theater, generally that related to a specific island effort or island campaign. After that battle, they would be pulled off, they would get R&R, they'd get retrained for the next battle. So there was a constant motion in and out of theater, or at least in and out of the combat area. That doesn't happen in a war with no lines, as we learned in Vietnam. But in Vietnam, if you were involuntarily mobilized, meaning you were drafted, you would generally not serve longer than 11 to 13 months in theater. That was kind of the deal. If you were taken out of your real life and put into the military involuntarily, they'd use you up and then they'd spit you out. It was only the career people, generally, that would serve more than one tour. We have a situation where 3 and 4 tours are very common. I did 2 in Iraq and 1 in Afghanistan. We have a situation where we've also changed the way in which we fight the war, and here's what I mean by that. World War II Korea, a little bit to Vietnam, the tooth-to-tail ratio, meaning the trigger pullers to the support, was somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 10. Meaning for every 1 trigger puller, there were 10 folks in support, truck drivers, cooks, all the things necessary to keep an army in the field. In this war, because of the policies of the past administration and the increase in contracted efforts, we actually now have a 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 ratio, which means, if you put it all together, soldiers now are going more often for longer tours, and instead of a 1 to 10 chance of being in sustained combat for a lot of time, now it's a 1 to 3 or 1 to 4 chance. So we really have the tip of a very large iceberg that we just frankly don't know the size of, but we're trying to do the best with what we can. One other thing needs to be recognized, this was mentioned earlier by Mr. Burton, we have an extraordinarily large seismic shifting kind of size change in women serving in the military. In Vietnam, 7,500 to 8,000 women served during the Vietnam conflict, largely in the medical field and in some support. Fully 22% of our force now is women. The lines have gone away, and we have women that have earned Silver Stars. We have combat medics from the 101st Airborne. They can't be infantry, but they're helping the infantry guy and gal, or at least infantry guy, in the same APC. So about 185,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, that number is actually pretty conservative. We think it's closer to about 190,000 or 200,000 by now. But we know for a fact that 185,000 have served, which is a huge number if you think about the long-term consequences. So let's go to some of the specifics. The origin of the task force really came out of the 2007 session. We found out that there were a number of issues that the veterans groups had differing opinions about, legislative partners had differing ideas about, and there were, even then, finite resources. So we know now there's finer resources, but nonetheless, we recognize that we just couldn't be in a situation where we weren't working on the same page. So Governor issued Executive Order 0808, informed us to put together a task force, which I think, quite frankly, of all the things I've done in government over the last 20 years, I've never worked with a finer group of people who have truly driven this entire process. The core group that's here today, they went above and beyond. The only thing that they were compensated for, and I'm going to brag their thing, is we made about a $5 challenge coin for all the members of the task force. But they drove to town hall meetings across the state on their own dime. They did a number of different things all out of an act of love. And the 27 members plus about 50 what we called the kind of the camp followers that were different folks that were helping us as we went throughout the process, and the 530 people that participated in the town hall meetings, it was just an extraordinary process. And I think the state was well served. But the mission was ultimately to do just that, bring everybody together so we could look at federal, state, and local policies, to look at education, employment, health care, housing, retirement. And as we went along, we found out that family issues and women veterans issues needed some specific attention, and that was something very helpful. So the process was to look at major policy programs to do public outreach, though we didn't really anticipate 24 community town halls. We kind of thought about six at the beginning. It was an extraordinary process that I wouldn't really change. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, we were trying to bring people around the table to give you a report that provided our best guess on what the recommendations should be with scarce resources. I want to be very clear. You're going to get a lot of veterans bills this session. You are, every session you do. And most of those veterans bills are good. They're good and decent things. We will be up here arguing and advocating that those 39 recommendations over the next 4 years and the task force bills that fit within the budget this year are the priority. When you look at the entire picture, they're the priority. And all of us to a person will advocate that if you have to choose, we advocate that you choose these programs instead of the other bills. Not that they're not good bills, not that they don't have a lot of thought behind them, but we don't have a lot of maneuver room. We have scarce resources, and we believe our mission is to provide you with the best information with the best bang for your buck. And that's why we're going to be very clear about the bills that we support and the bills that we don't dislike, just that aren't a priority at this time. So let's go through them. Number one, Executive Order 0903 was signed last week, and it basically requires all state agencies, as they change their forms electronically or in paper, to put a bullet on there that basically says, if you would like additional information about veteran services, provide your contact information. All that contact information will go to a person at ODVA and will be farmed out to the relevant VSOs. One of the things we recognized is that there's a lot of programs that people don't know that they have benefits and access to because they just don't know it. And we worked with the agency administrators to make sure this would be a very low-cost thing, and that as they update forms, as they go through the normal process, and technologies change, so they do that, it would provide only the name, email, phone number, address, contact information, nothing that is protected by any kind of privacy. But and again, purely voluntary disclosure. Person doesn't want us to check it, they don't have to check it. But if they do, it's an opportunity to try to get folks involved in the system, and they may actually be entitled to something they don't know about. Next point, we've not really done a lot of work on this beyond trying to conceptualize it because of the complexities, but we recognize that there is an amount of data right now that different agencies, because of differing views on HIPAA and other programs, aren't currently sharing with each other. For example, if a veteran is receiving a certain kind of care and it's known in one agency, the next agency over may not know that. So we're trying to figure out a way that protects privacy of the veteran, but at the same time make sure that the government's doing everything it can for someone that is entitled to something. Next, education. This is really the crown jewel, if you will, of the program, and it also has a little bit of confusion surrounding it, at least among two or three boisterous individuals. The VSO at the public universities and campus, what we're calling it, is the Campus VSO Program. Here's the nuts and bolts of it. Governor Kulongoski last year said he wanted to put together a GI Bill for the National Guard. We can't afford to do that. But fortunately, the United States Congress passed the most modern GI Bill since World War II. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's not perfect for the Guard, but it's better than nothing. It's better than what we have. And because of that, we said, you know, what we need is, for the folks that are going to take advantage of that, we need to have a VSO on campus that's connected in, that can actually make sure that they're not only getting the GI Bill benefits, because that actually is done often on campus through federal education people, but that every other benefit that they may have earned, that they're getting as well, so that we can maximize that. Now, it's good for the community because it brings in tax-free revenue. It's good for the veteran and their family because it maximizes whatever benefits they've earned. And it's actually good for the overall system because we believe that the partnership between the campus VSO and the on-campus education person that's currently funded through the federal government on every campus will make it a higher priority to reach out to veterans and explain the opportunities of the new GI Bill. We did a pilot program at Portland State. It was a wild success. We know that at current budget levels, we can't afford the 18 that we'd like to have. So we're proposing 5, which is in the governor's budget, and those 5 will be circuit riders. And here's the piece. It really isn't a separate program as much as it's a separate kind of community we're trying to outreach to. And it also does not impinge or infringe upon the current formulas for county VSOs. It doesn't modify or change the other state VSOs' functions that are currently there. What it does, it simply expands the opportunity on campus to make sure that those campus communities and the veterans therein are getting all the opportunities that they can get. And we're going to be, the reason that we need to keep them state employees in this particular case is because at this point with only 5, we're going to have a very aggressive circuit rider approach that's going to cross county boundaries, that's going to basically be all over. But we're going to try to emphasize and showcase in 2 years what we've been able to do with those 5 to make the case next session for potential expansion. If we can't make the case, then we'll modify. But we think the case will be made. So that's an important thing. We believe that it will actually fundamentally transform the college experience for not just the veteran, but their entire family. It'll also help the Guard specifically because it will get them the benefits that right now, under the current programs, they may not otherwise be realizing. The second one down is one that there's a couple of bills floating out there, and I want to kind of explain the process for this task force. We had to get bills in August before we were getting all the different finer points together. Working with Representative Edwards, we have reached, I think, a very clear concept. We're just trying to get the language to the point where it does what we want it to do. Here's what we're trying to do. State of Ohio actually passed a bond and passed a bill that said that every veteran in Ohio is in resident for tuition. Ultimately, I think the policy is that that would be a good place to go. However, can't always afford what's a good policy. So what we decided was, well, if you look at the numbers, there is a way to kind of have our cake and eat it too. We're calling it the auto waiver. And the idea works like this. There are some federal programs that will pay out-of-state tuition. Well, we don't want to deny ourselves the opportunity to accept the federal money for out-of-state tuition. On the other hand, we don't want that to be a barrier for a veteran to be coming to school in Oregon and bringing their benefits and potentially their life experience to make our community stronger. So what we're offering is an amendment to the bill that will basically say that the on-campus authority, whether it's the registrar or the president or whoever it is, can automatically waiver a veteran that has a GI Bill or a program that doesn't pay out-of-state tuition. So that for the veteran, it's transparent. And in most cases, it'll simply be bypassing the 6 to 7 to 8 month process that already exists, so it doesn't actually require a new law or at least a new process per se, because right now people can appeal their residency status. All this does is simply cuts the time down and the bureaucratic red tape and says, all right, does your program pay for it? Yes or no? If it doesn't, we'll auto-waiver it. But if it does, we're going to accept your money. That's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to have our cake and eat it too. And again, ultimately, this isn't going to affect a whole lot of veterans. It's the message that matters most in this case, that Oregon is open-armed, whether it's if you want to go to college, you want to go to work, whatever you want to do, we want to try to help support them. The last one is not a bill yet, but I wanted to give you a heads up on what we're trying to do. We're trying to establish a pilot program at Eastern Oregon University and potentially Portland State in a partnership, centered around trying to make some of the unused dormitories that are currently at Eastern Oregon and some of the programs that are at Eastern Oregon more veteran-friendly and actually trying to make a hub out there that provides kind of the not just Eastern Oregon but parts of Washington and Idaho with something special because we have so many Guard folks out that way. Right now we're working with nonprofits to do some of that. I'm not asking for any money for this program, but more of just letting you know we're going to work on a pilot project out there. And again, the piece for that is that Eastern Oregon has a very well-developed distance learning program, which is appealing to a lot of vets. Okay, unemployment. A couple of things here. Most of these won't cost you any money, so I know that they're going to be favored. First is increasing the DVOP Leaver staffing throughout Oregon. DVOP Leaver is a federal program, Disabled Veterans Outreach Program, local veterans employment representatives. Ironically, though we have increased the number of veterans over the last 7 years, we've actually decreased the number of DVOP and leavers out there to help the veterans get a job when they're done serving their country. We're appealing, and in fact, during the last week, I made myself a nuisance talking to the newest members of our congressional delegation, as well as some of the mature members of the delegation, as well as poor Brian Baird, who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, that ultimately the DVOP Leaver program needs to be at least back to where it was before they started whacking away. Because ultimately, whether it's the VSO or the Leaver DVOP, it is a touch point where people get help, get assistance, and they communicate with each other. It's essential. What we're asking for is a memorial supporting that effort. The development and funding of a Public Information Oregon Hire Vets Initiative, Clackamas County actually got some federal money for that a while back. It's a good program. We're not asking for large funds on that, but we want the recognition that it's important. And then ultimately, kind of skipping out of the bottom one, which is the most exciting, we had a situation where we're looking at trying to provide some types of tax incentives for employers, not just to hire veterans, because actually this body worked on that with Senate Bill 822 last time about hiring preferences, but rather the retention issue. Because what happens is most employers are trying to do the patriotic thing right now. They really are, most. They're good for one deployment for a reservist or National Guard person. But that second and third one's a little hard to do when you're trying to make ends meet in a rough economy. So we met with a number of business leaders, and we said, what would be the best plan? And the reason it was an issue is we're starting to recognize that there have been a spike in the Uniformed Servicemen's Employment Reemployment Act violations. It's the law that says that if you are called to serve, you come back to a job that is equal to or commensurate with the job that you had. There are ways around that, and human resources people have gotten very creative in the last 4 years getting around that. So we have a problem. And while I'm all about making a bigger hammer to punch people when they're messing up, I'm also about trying to find a way to help people do the right thing so everybody keeps face and people get helped. So we thought about tax credits. But the business community actually said, no, we don't want that. That's not the right thing. The patriotic thing here to do is for businesses to step up. So what we're going to do is, on the one hand, Dan Estes is leading an effort to put an education campaign through a number of business organizations where people understand what USERRA does and make it more aware, so there's not any confusion that it is, in fact, a federal law. On the other hand, we're going to be working with a number of businesses that have said that they are interested in doing this to help establish a compact. And in theory, it would work that every business that enters the compact would commit to the following. If a returning member comes to their business and they can't put them exactly where they were before, another business in the compact will give that member a full-time job at a similar rate and a similar scale. So the businesses actually help each other make sure that there's a network. No state funds, not a government program. We're simply helping facilitate the business community standing up for their values, which I think if we can pull this off, it would be an amazing thing. So I wanted to let you know about that. That's not a bill. It's just letting you know.
But as we have some more clarification
Absolutely.
On that, could you include some reports on the implementation of Senate Bill 822 from
Sure.
last time? I've had some questions raised about that.
Right, absolutely.
I'd like to include that.
Yep.
Thank you.
Absolutely, my chair. On health recommendations, I'll try to keep this one a little bit briefer. I know I'm going on a little bit. Bottom line, we need to fully fund the categories 1 through 8 of the Veterans Health Administration programs. Categories 1 through 8, as with all things, there's a bureaucratic process. Ones are folks that have the highest need and are getting, in large measure, very good care. The VA system as a whole, once you get into it, is providing excellent care. RAND Corporation says it's one of the best in the world. The problem is access to the system, and the problem is that the previous administration did not put as much money into the VA system as necessary for the spikes in Vietnam veterans coming in that they didn't anticipate, and the cost of the OIF, OEF care, because ultimately medicine has really evolved, and we have, I mean, the good news, bad news is we're saving a lot more kids that otherwise wouldn't be saved, but the costs are through the roof. So we need to get to a point where we fully fund Category 1 through 8. President Obama during the campaign committed to this. Many members of Congress committed to this. I'm asking you, pleading with you, we'll do whatever we need to do to help get the memorial passed through this body, but more than the memorial passed, I'm asking each of you individually to use every network you have to try to move the Congress to do the right thing on this. This is absolutely essential, and ultimately, for states like ours that can't deficit spend, if we can actually get the vets that have the opportunity to be accessing the best VA care in the world, or best medical care in the world, it will actually move pressure off our state resources and free up capabilities. This is one of those win-win type of things that's the right thing to do. It's also politically the best thing to do. On TRICARE, at some point we need to have a discussion with our congressional partners about the TRICARE reimbursement rates. Ultimately, last session we tried to find a way that would help for a number of reasons, and we don't have time right now to explain. It didn't work out like we thought it would, mostly having to do with interpretation of what we thought was pretty clear writing. But bottom line, it was nibbling at the edges. The problem is TRICARE rate is too low. Physicians can't afford to do that, and or not just physicians, medical care providers can't afford to do that, and every other federal program that is not reimbursed at the rate of service. So that's something we need to have a talk about. And then bottom point is we need to look at increased flexibility and partnerships in remote and rural areas. One of the common threads throughout this entire experience is, not a surprise for Oregon policymakers, there's a metro concern and a metro need, and there's also a remote and rural area need. In this case, they're all veterans. It's just different problems based on where you live trying to access different kinds of benefits. All equal, just a little different. On housing, greater flexibility in VA housing. We're looking at trying to use some of the federal funds that actually have been set aside for homelessness. But as programs and policies develop, right now we don't have a particular bill for you on this other than a memorial to Congress asking for more flexibility. But there are programs out there in Oregon right now that, quite frankly, probably out of necessity happened, but are model programs. Whether it's the Central Oregon Veterans Outreach or two or three programs in Portland that are very good, there is an opportunity. There are federal dollars available. We have to get smarter about allowing funds to be shared among partners that are trying to do the same thing. And I understand why a lot of those safeguards were put in place, but we have to examine some of those firewalls, I think. Second one is a constitutional referral. Which one is it?
HJR3.
Actually, Representative Maurer, Representative Holvey are probably going to be taking that project on. They both have introduced bills on this. Bottom line is this. The 30-year cap that's currently in the Constitution and the very confusing veterans definition that is in the Constitution, we're trying to change. It will require a little bit of help at the federal level on the IRS code. It will, which we think we can do fairly easily because of the progress that was made last congressional session having to do with these types of matters. But ultimately, we have a situation where veterans are living longer than people thought they would. So folks that have gotten out of service 30 years ago or 31 years ago go in, they've saved their money, they're ready to buy their house, and ultimately they can't because there's a 30-year limit on it. There's also a question about what is a veteran. According to Tom and others, there's something like 7 different definitions of a veteran in statute. So what we're trying to do in this one particular bill is reference a particular statute for veterans that is the most inclusive to make sure that National Guard and reservists aren't cut out of the deal. For a lot of years, the federal government did really goofy things with mobilizations to make sure that reservists didn't get full veteran status because it was a cost issue. So we're trying to get smarter than the mousetrap. Other thing is, again, developing and funding local partnership incentives for local housing options. As some of these issues come more clear, I will certainly come back to the committee, Chair Cowan, and explain. But right now, quite frankly, we're just getting our feet under us on these issues, trying to push forward.
But recommendations. We're ready to start hearing some of these bills. So as soon as we get organized, we'll have it.
Well, we're trying to do the bills that we have listed in the PowerPoint. We're ready to go on. It's just we're trying to catch up. It was a fast year. Expansion of eligibility for program expenditures for whole family initiatives. Here's the funny thing, and going back to the 185,000 women serving, the military is undergoing, like society, a fundamental shift in the way that it operates. For years, 200 and some, it was the men that were serving. So concern about whole family concepts weren't necessarily, I'm not saying they weren't thought about, but they weren't a priority. We're now entering a different age where a woman who often women still end up with the children after a relationship fails, can't access the same benefits that her male counterpart can because of the responsibilities of being the parent. And it just does not make sense to us that that it's unequal treatment. So we recognize that there needs to be at the federal level some discussion about expansion of the whole family concept initiatives. Added to that, especially for the Guard and Reserve, it is no longer just the serviceman that goes to war or the servicewoman that goes to war. The entire family goes to war. The entire community goes to war. And here's the secret. It's never going back to the way it was. So we've got to get smarter about the way we do these things. We want to look at increases, and again, this is asking for more money, but I can explain why it's important. The Emergency Relief Fund for Veterans, just like the Emergency Relief Fund for the military, it's a small amount, small dollar, crisis-oriented type of help that we provide with the increasing unemployment and the increasing volatility of the economy. We're running out of those funds faster than we ever have before for people that, in a lot of cases, are just caught between one world and the other, and they need just a little bit of a bridge. So we'll be back trying to ask for as much as you can give us for that. There will be a bill on veterans courts. Really, that can be for another discussion, but ultimately it's very similar to the concept of drug courts, where instead of focusing simply on the punishment, it's also looking at trying to find a formula to help the person get back on their feet. The veterans court will also involve veterans, and veterans actually are pretty good at sniffing out stories about truth and lies from other veterans, so we actually think it's going to have a positive effect on many ways. The biggest one that really is, there's two biggest ones, I guess. The suicide prevention, not surprise or news to you, but over the last 5 weeks, we had something in the neighborhood of 6 military deaths. One likely overseas was a suicide, and 3 in the state, or at least of folks that were living in the states. This is becoming a larger issue. It's something that we're going to have to get smarter about. There's a lot of reasons for it. No one's going to have the magic cure, but we have to find ways to reach out. We have to find ways to make sure and harness our resources to do the most good that we can. The last point on this for families is an establishment of an Oregon Military Families Appreciation Day. Now, the longer you serve in this legislature, you're going to have lots of people come up and say, we want this bill passed so you can have Maple Leaf Day or Oregon Beaver Day, or, well, no one would really want a Duck Day, but those types of things. This is different than that. What this is about is not just setting aside a day a year that's for military family appreciation, but we're working with the AOC, Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and the Family Support Network that Scott leads. And the idea is that there will actually be shared curriculum throughout the communities on that particular day. So 30 minutes or an hour of simply awareness of how mobilizations actually affect the community. There will actually be some kind of community service project, whether it's planting a tree or doing something on a park or whatever it is. And then there will be some kind of food. Very small, very simple, but something that brings people together to recognize that when a military member goes away, it isn't just their family that's affected, but somebody has to fill in for the military member that went away. So we're excited about that. Reintegration has been talked about a lot. I just want to talk very briefly about the 90-day soft landing. Chair Cowan, you mentioned about the family piece. The concept, and maybe I didn't do a good job of explaining it, the concept is to actually get them back into their home garrison during that 90 days. So they're with their families. But right now, they get 5 to 7 days and they're done. With this process, they get 90 days on a first month full, second month three-quarter, third month half pay. So there isn't that rush to get back. So you find a job to be able to pay the bank note on the house and all the other pressures. And instead of the rush, as you talked about, Representative Boone, of standing in the way between the families, they have the time to basically unwind in such a way, not sufficient probably to be quote-unquote normal again, because I think us vets are never really normal, well, probably in the first place, but certainly
never normal.
Never normal. But at least 30 to 90 days of the opportunity to, at a slower pace, have the docs look at them, have the skill set tests taken, do the kinds of things to prepare them. And the theory is that after the first 30 days, the commander and first sergeant, if the person has a plan, they could release them, so they're done. They can go do what they want to do. But for those that don't have everything together, there's no shame or no confusion because everybody's enrolled in a program at first and then they're kind of whittled away as they have individual plans. And we think that that's modeled after a lot of the police and fire intervention programs, where it used to be if you if you had a shooting, you had to say you needed help, and no one would because there was a stigma, well, this way, and now it's everybody gets involved in the program. Same kind of thing. Because we know there's a problem. We know we can't get to them any other way. And ultimately, the Army, when we talked with one of the bureaucrats that was out last year, they explained that they understood it was the kind of program they needed. They just couldn't afford it. Well, my counterargument to that and my request for you all on this to push at the congressional level, and again, Senator Wyden has taken this on as a priority for him. If we don't pay now, we sure will pay later. I mean, this also, in addition to just doing the right thing, I'm concerned because the other side of my hat is helping General Caldwell make sure that we have 8,500 folks ready to go to war again. If we aren't resetting and reconstituting the force and making sure that they're good to go by doing these kinds of what I think are preventative measures, then we're not only going to be not treating veterans right, but we're not going to be able to sustain a National Guard that we depend upon. I mean, this is a force readiness issue just as much as it is a fairness issue. On retirement, yeah, you can read that as well as I can. Bottom line is, the in-residence care for aging veterans, we have to get more creative about our partnerships. There will be another veterans home. The legislature passed the authority for that last session. But we're also looking at leasing and creative sharing opportunities that I think that the federal government will be more supportive of. So we're excited about some of those opportunities. When it comes to transportation, just like the rest of Oregon, the development of transportation enhancements for local veterans assistance is important. We have a situation now where, quite literally, and I want to emphasize, I truly appreciate the volunteer spirit of the folks doing it. But we often have people that probably shouldn't be driving a van in 20-degree snowy weather across the pass, trying to get their 10 or 12 or 15-year older buddies to the hospital in the way that we're doing it right now. I mean, I think that's not right. And I go back to the story in Gold Beach during the town hall where this Navy widow, her husband fought World War II in Korea. He died on the way to the VA hospital in a fog because he had been driving up there and back. Now, one could argue they probably should have tried to find a way to stay up maybe there if there were going to be so many appointments, but ultimately they couldn't afford to do that. So we just have to get smarter. And there's a memorial asking the Congress to look at transportation, and the reason for that is either they start providing fee basis and more flexibility on the VA side in terms of care, or we get smarter about getting people to and from the care. I mean, we've got to do one or the other. And especially in Oregon, we know transportation is an issue. We're asking a bill. Which bill is it? Well, we're asking for a bill to put together a task force on this, and here's why. One of the recognition is, thank you, Senate Bill 98. One of the points that we learned through this task force process is that in the constrained time we had, there were two or three issues that we figured we just didn't have enough time to be able to come to you looking in the eye and say we have the definitive answer. On transportation, we don't know what we don't know. What we do know is that it warrants further study, and we do know who should be around the table. Because they're on the state level, separate from the federal government, there are a number of transit districts, there are a number of local fixes that different communities have that could be woven together into the fabric, but we just didn't have the time to get you the right answer. So we're asking for more time on that. Again, no funding attached, but more time and the authority from the legislature to look into it so there is an official sanction to do so. Moving on to last recommendations. You're going to be very happy. My voice will be off your ears in a minute. The establishment, and this is a very important one, there will be a bill. We're not sure what number yet because Senator Johnson and Representative Gelser and others are sponsoring this. But the establishment of a task force to look at the feasibility of transitioning the Eastern Oregon Training Center and another facility inside the Mid-Willamette Valley into an in-residence care facility for women, veterans, and families. Here's some more numbers for you that I found somewhat interesting. There are, west of the Mississippi, about 12 beds for women veterans for in-residence care. 12. And a lot of them are facilities where there are male veterans. For some of the issues that women veterans are asking to get help with, being in the same facility with a male isn't exactly the best prescriptive method. So what we're going to try to do is put together the folks that can make this kind of thing happen, certified, smart, big brain people, And that's what we're asking for the task force. We don't think it will be a long-term deal. We don't think it will take a lot of time. But we want, A, the official sanction from the legislature to do this. And, B, we want to make sure that we can get the right people around the table to make it work the right way. Because ultimately, if we have one in Eastern Oregon and one in the Valley, regardless of your particular background, the woman veteran will find one that is more or less comfortable for their particular needs. And we just think that that's a very important thing to do. We also need to get better about public information campaigns for military sexual trauma. And especially the mental health care access for women veterans in remote and rural areas. We already know that mental health care in general is tough to get in remote and rural areas. It's tougher for veterans, and it's tougher for women veterans. So you can read the future studies recommendations as well as I can. There's lots of work to do in the future, but ultimately before us we have the House bills. You have the list up there. You can read it as well as I can. We've tried to tailor it. The promise I'm making you again, I started with this, I'm going to kind of start to wrap up with this. The bills that the task force puts forward to you, we certainly don't expect a rubber stamp, but we believe that to a person we can all advocate for these particular bills as part of a larger mosaic. Because ultimately, the veterans policy is so interwoven with so many different other programs that there are some gaps and there are some places we need to put emphasis. Most of this is federal. Most of it is. We need to kick the Congress in the behind and actually make those things happen. And again, I'm not asking to pass a memorial that simply goes in the record and everybody can clap their hands and say it's over. I'm asking for your personal commitment to take that memorial, to go through the National Conference of State Legislators, to push Director Willis and myself and others through the National Government Association, other organizations that are working on things, and whatever other networks you have, whether it's through unions or business organizations, to try to get this right. Because ultimately, we have about a two-year window before veterans' issues no longer are important. In fact, I'm not even sure with the economy the way it is, we have 2 years. But with Iraq and Afghanistan, when the music stops, we're going to have a significant problem if we don't get a hold of it. This is our opportunity. This is our chance. And we desperately need your help to do that. So I'm going to stop there and try to field any questions you have or do the artful dodge if I can't answer the question.
If there are specific questions for Paul now, please keep in mind that each of these bills is going to come back to this committee for further study, so it probably isn't the time for deep analysis without the bill in front of us.
There is one thing.
Senator or Representative Escobel. I don't know. You just became a senator. Whatever.
It disturbed me when we talked about a veteran coming back to their job in a similar job and similar pay. That wording bothers me if that's the case. Bothers me.
Yes.
Because what is similar?
Well, ironically, the federal government interprets similar, if you're in the postal service, as if you are a mail carrier, you go to be a mail carrier again. You may not get the route that you've earned through years of patience and waiting, like my master sergeant didn't get when he came back, but they can look to the courts and say they're still a mail carrier. In jobs or in vocations where there's not a set job description that is as detailed, it gets kind of wacky sometimes. I mean, again, most employers do the best they can. But there are some. Some of them actually have been in the newspapers in the last year or two, how they've messed with people, that don't want to deal, quote-unquote, with having to put someone back into place. Because if you're an employer, there's a gap, there's a hole, you fill it with somebody, you start liking Bob or Sally or whoever's filling the gap, and when Tom comes back after fighting the war, Tom probably a little bit different than when we sent Tom away. He's got some issues, a little harder to deal with maybe. Not always, but sometimes. And the business doesn't really sometimes want to do that. The frustrating part is, from my perspective, not just having been, well, being a veteran, is that ultimately, for a vet coming back, one of the best ways try to get them back into life is to feel like they have a purpose again. And a job, especially for Americans, is a very important thing. And I think a lot of times employers don't understand the psychological piece of that job component because they're trying to make a buck. And you can't fault them for that in this economy. They're doing the best they can. But it's an issue. And the similar same, by the way, is federal law. I would like it more precise.
Madam Chairman, if you don't mind, I'd like to speak to that just a little bit.
Certainly.
Okay, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. One of the key things this legislative body did in 2005, and I think you can be proud of, is that for government employees and PERS employees, is the legislature allowed for a public employer to hire a retired member of the PERS system, bring them back in to fill a employed guardsman or reservist or an active duty person for that matter, bring that person back in to fill for that person while they were deployed. We sought that legislation because we had situations where we had qualified retirees, policemen, firemen, who were willing to work and willing to come back and do it and very willing to go back into retirement. So we didn't end up in the situation that Paul just described where you had to backfill the position and suddenly you say, well, this guy is a little, you know, he's doing a lot better job maybe than you did, and I don't want to let him go. And it was particularly important to small communities because they have such a small bench. They have 5 or 6 10-man police department, fire department, whatever the case may be. And that's worked out very well. However, believe it or not, a lot of agencies don't know that. And we do our best effort we can to let people know about that. We have calls that come to our Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve Program, who Colonel Retired Elliott is in the back of the room, and he runs that. And we've been pushing that out as fast and hard as we can. Now, we can't do the same for private employers.
Right.
And we have situations where we had one that was one 16th guy. He was a mechanic for a school district working on the buses. The school district, while he was deployed, made the decision to go to private contracting for their entire transportation needs. He came back and didn't have a job, and there was no protection for him. And his family was very, very distraught over that situation because in the 18 months he was deployed, they had made these changes in the way they did business, and they're zero protection for that individual.
That, if I could follow up on that, Madam Chair, that is something that needs to be, that there's a future policy issue as well. The way the workforce moves now, there is a lot more contracted out, especially in high tech, than long-term employers.
Right.
There is no protection under current federal USERRA standards for that environment. As an adjunct instructor at Western Oregon, when I got called up for 2 years, I came back and they'd actually hired my dad and kept my dad instead of me, which was a double whammy for me. But nonetheless, the
experience,
right? but that contract piece is tip of an iceberg, and the general's talking specifically about as we have more and more mobilizations, and this becomes more and more common. You know, 90% of the guys coming back are going to be great on all cylinders, doing wonderful things. And there are some few that have those problems, and we don't want businesses to get used to having easy outs. So I'll freeze there.
Well, I think this is an area that we need more conversation on, and frankly, the workforce is changing, and the job that you started out with and you have the rest of your life isn't the same kind
Absolutely.
Of situation.
Absolutely. And I think this folds back into what you heard earlier from one of the earlier, I think it was Colonel McCrae, talked about, you know, when we were building this bike while we rode it when we first started the reintegration program. 60% of that battalion that deployed didn't have employment when they left. So we knew that they were going to be unemployed when they came back. We produced a massive job fair. We filled up the building, our Anderson Readiness Center, with employers, most of which I talked to, all indicated that they would hire a veteran tomorrow. All they got to do is say yes, even if they didn't have the background. Why? Because they would show up to work on time. They'd be there for 5 days instead of on day 3 saying, I needed a mental health day. They'd show up with the right proper attire on, and he said, and I'll train them what they need to know. Out of that 60%, which in that battalion was somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 and some individuals, not one single person took a job. And we were mortified because we'd invited all these employers in to partake in this thing, thinking we were doing the right thing. We couldn't figure it out. We just were just absolutely mortified. So we started asking the soldiers as they were ready to leave, did any of you take a job? Well, I took a few cards. And what we discovered was that they simply, in 7 days out of a combat zone, can't decompress and say, yeah, I want to be this or that or the other thing. So we recognized then that we didn't really know what we were doing. And so we wait 3 to 6 months, get a feel for the unit through the command, and go to them then with job fairs, which have turned out to be far more successful. We're employing more people through this system, and we're getting a lot better response. We do these job fairs in conjunction with the Oregon Department of Employment. We've had great participation from employers, from private employers, and they're very willing to show up, and they're very willing to hire these young men and these women. A lot of them want, as was also indicated earlier, they're not ready to go back and do what they did before. They may have had a job, may have been at a McDonald's or someplace like that, and they simply can't do that. They've had life and death decision-making responsibilities for 18 months, and all of a sudden they're going to go back and be a hamburger flipper at McDonald's. They just can't do it. So we've got to figure out, how do we get those people into training, how do we get them more education, and how do they sustain themselves and their families while we're doing all that? So it's a very complex situation. It's extremely hard to deal with. And I can tell you that, in most part, we've done a fairly good job. But we always have the ones that slide through the cracks that we hear about, usually through law enforcement or maybe through a family program, because their spouse has used our 800 number, called up and said, I got a problem. And that's a small percentage, but it's still a percentage, and it still hurts when you see that happen, as hard as we try. So it's still a work in progress. It's not a perfect system, and we're continuing to work it all the time.
And we will continue to talk about trying to improve our reintegration efforts. So I appreciate that. Also would like to talk a little as we go along about coordination with some of the other efforts that are going on. The suicide prevention is the one that jumped right into my mind as an example, because we're having those same kind of conversations around mental health services and in human services. So let's see if we can't make some connectivity between what state government does and how we can make those things go together. So.
There was some information I think was that I sent to your office this morning, or maybe
that related to suicide
numbers? Yes, I think you'd asked for it. Did you get that?
I did, and we'll get it out to the committee. And
And it is frightening.
Very interesting when you look at a bar graph and the age brackets, and you can relate that to some of the events in our lifetime. So that's why I'd like to have that.
Yes, ma'am.
And it needs some
coordination
discussion
between the two.
Yes.
With that, I would just like to say thank you once again for today's presentation, and for all of you for taking your time on the task force and then taking your time again to come here today. We appreciate that very much. And we will get back to these issues one at a time as we kind of pick them off in bills or groups of bills, because I'm going to try to group it around subject areas, education, health care, that sort of thing. So.
And, Madam Chair, what I'd like to offer, and to the folks that are in the back, as we get those in groupings, different members of the task force had different focuses. And as much as we can get the folks involved, the better for everybody, because they saw a lot of things that no one of us saw all of it. So
that will be great, working with our very able staff and putting the bills together as we have them ready. Let's try to get you just as timely information as possible on what days we can maybe put one group together around different subject areas. So I thank you. I also want to just recognize briefly that we know that there is a mobilization ceremony on Thursday the 29th. I believe that's an aviation group, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
That's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, which just happens to hit right in the middle of this committee, and we really do have a pretty full workload. I don't feel that we can cancel committee that day. With General Caldwell's help, I know that of the 102 being called up, 39 individuals are constituents of some committee member. You might want to check that out a little more thoroughly. So with apologies, I don't believe that we can excuse the entire committee, but I will entertain a request from a committee member or two if we feel like somebody should go and represent the committee, and please pass our best wishes along to this group.
Yes, ma'am, and Madam Chair, I apologize. Part of me being out of sorts for the last few days, I was not able to get you the updated schedule for that. It's still at 2. Just as we get more information about those events, I'll forward that to you and Patrick and Mr. Molina.
Okay.
Thank you.
With that, thank you, and we will adjourn.